Once meditation develops to the point where the surface tensions in the mind and body dissipate, even for short periods of time, and you metaphorically begin to see beneath the surface of things, much of what you're still seeing is your conditioned mind. The conditioned mind is what human beings live in most of the time. It's the mind that's making decisions, that's analyzing things, comparing things, remembering things, planning things. The feelings that you're having, whatever they might be, or mood states throughout the course of the day, are part of the conditioned mind. Your reactions, particularly the reactions of liking and disliking, are expressions of the conditioned mind. So even as you drop beneath the surface, like you can kind of feel yourself sinking inward, you come inside more deeply, much of what you still see are these qualities of the conditioned mind. The promise, the purpose, the promise, the gift of spirituality, of meditation, is to not only give you a clear insight or grouping of insights, usually it's a grouping of insights, into the conditioned mind, to see the conditioned mind clearly. And with that, to see that you, whatever you sense yourself as, and sometimes you view yourself as those forces of conditioning, that you are more than just a conditioned mind. Until you see the conditioned mind, and you might use the word enough, or clearly, or directly, you will be to varying degrees identified with it. There's really no other way to be until there's an awakening beyond the conditioned mind. Now, the awakening beyond the conditioned mind, as I'm describing it, needs to take place, you might say, through clear observation of the conditioned mind. You have to see what's actually here. Another part of the conditioned mind is, of course, defense mechanisms. Okay, one's not allowing those aspects of conditioning to happen, one's actually defending against them, and sometimes defending against the defense against the defense. You've got this layering sometimes, it's there, which manifests for human beings as suffering and tension. You might have a state of anger. Instead of that anger being allowed, there could be an aversion to the anger, or fear of the anger, or sadness about the anger. An identification with the anger, and then a sort of a going with that anger and feeding that anger. This happens to people sometimes. They get caught up in, and they begin to actually, in a strange kind of way, feed on the anger. They're probably the only person around getting apparently nourished by it, but there they are yelling again at the children, or at their spouse, or at their co-worker, or their employee, or even their friends, so-called friends. So here we have the conditioned mind proliferating itself, feeding upon itself, and thus rolling in itself. Okay? So within that which I just described, to see the forces of liking and disliking, these two forces of the conditioned mind are critical, because until those forces are seen, you might say fairly clearly, they tend to operate, and sometimes operate very ongoingly, and even unbeknownst to the person, they're governing the person's perceptions and the way in which they behave and what they do and so forth. And of course, the choices that the person perceives that they're making can be governed by and conditioned by that forces of liking and disliking. They're trying to stay in the realm of what they like and avoid the realm of what they don't like. What happens as the meditation develops is that these things are seen, and the observing of them is kind of like a cleansing effect. In other words, as anything is seen clearly, it tends to not only show itself for what it is, but it tends to not be such a influencing, or in this case now, inhibiting factor on one's life. There's a loosening that takes place. There's a kind of an opening. Somebody call this a sort of a letting go takes place, and all that's really happening is those movements of those conditioned mind forces are loosening. You might say they're softening. You might say this is quite an encounter because the conditioned mind is extremely powerful. Most mornings when you wake up, you could say, we could probably agree upon this, you're waking up out of this sort of unknown world, which is in some ways a representative of the peacefulness of the unconditioned, into the conditioned. Boom, there it is again. First thought, and then a decision, and then I've got to do that, and then it starts rolling. Unless there's an interest, and it's an interest that needs to be really sincere, and in a way, for many people, ongoing. You might say a real devotion or commitment to look at this conditioned mind. Never mind if one's been exposed to the idea that there's something beyond this, that there's an awakening beyond conditioning. Never mind that. Some people just are, you might say, fortunate to look at the conditioning, to face it, to not react to it, to see it for what it is, and lo and behold, it starts to soften, it starts to open. And there's people without any kind of particular religious background, spiritual background, who are quite awake. They're quite awake in something beyond conditioning. Everyone in this room, anyone that would walk into this room, people who typically might come here and aren't here tonight, people who would never come to a setting like this, most human beings have some inkling of that which is beyond the conditioned mind. You don't have to meditate. You don't have to read about it. It's something that's there, and yet it's overlooked. It's overlooked again and again and again and again. Why? Because of the investment, the thickness of this identification with the conditioned life. This is what the Buddha called the field or the realm of samsara, perpetual wandering. And you can feel this perpetual wandering if you get into a sort of a period where you're struggling and you're starting to get frustrated and annoyed, or reaction is there, and you feel the discomfort of that, and you can kind of feel the whole body-mind process rolling into that. Even as you might be looking for relief, you're still rolling in it. And eventually, of course, you come out. Or you just, quit and go to sleep, if you can go to sleep. Because if you're reacting enough, you can't go to sleep. So I had a bad night's sleep. I couldn't sleep last night. Why couldn't you sleep last night, Paul? Well, I was rolling around in my reactive, conditioned mind. And those are words that people won't often say unless they're familiar with that kind of terminology. Well, I was upset. I was frustrated. I can't believe this is still going on. What's going on? Your conditioned mind is what's going on. That's what's going on. That's your problem until it isn't. They're going to put that on my tombstone if I have one. It was that way until it wasn't. That's what he said. But it's kind of true, isn't it? Things are the way they are. Things are the way they appear to be until they're not. So the meditation offers this fundamental, radical, loving, wise, commonsensical opportunity, and you might call it an alternative, not to negate, because if you push that conditioned mind down, you say, I'm going to smash you. It'll come right up like a volcano. It'll push right around your hand and say, you think you can squash me? Watch this. Boom. and it'll come flying back up. Because it needs to unfold itself. Good evening.
Good evening.
It needs to unfold itself. It will unfold itself, just like everything. Needs to and will unfold itself. So we begin to, whether we know it or not, as we sit and we allow something as simple as breathing to be as it is, we might see that, wow, I actually am spending a lot of time trying to control my experience. And I can feel this even now as I'm paying attention to my breathing. This instruction that I've heard called letting the breath breathe itself is actually quite difficult because I'm in there monkeying with things. We get to see that part of the conditioned mind, the tendency to control, the tendency to manipulate, the tendency to want things to be a certain way. If we never got things to be the way we want through trying to get things to be the way we want, we'd probably give it up right there. But that's not the way it works. Sometimes you want things to be a certain way, and you get it, don't you? But you never get it your way all the time, do you? That's critical. So this very scratching that this hand is doing on the back and the sensation that's there, okay? And you're free to go scratch this, and that's a metaphor as well as a literal thing. As you begin to sit, you're free to let things be, including the conditioned mind. As you let the conditioned mind be, it starts to unravel itself. It starts to open itself up and reveal itself to you. It's fascinating, it's agonizing, it's wonderful, it's disturbing, it's confusing, and ultimately it's enlightening to see this conditioned mind for what it is. So let's say you're the kind of meditator who uses the breathing, not that you need to be or should be, as a primary object. You've been exposed to a teaching that says, okay, let your attention rest in your breathing, and when it wanders to something else, notice that it's wandered, and then bring it back. Even in that very meditation, without knowing it, one could be controlling or attempting to control the experience. Guess what concentration is if you're not careful? It's just a way that you subtly control your experience. I'm not saying concentration is a bad thing. But if you're interested in awakening beyond conditioning, concentration is probably not going to be the vehicle or boat that takes you there. So I'll leave right now open the question, if concentration won't do it, what will? Because what happens is, if you get concentrated very deeply on your breathing or anything else, and you go into an absorption, and some of you know about these things, you go into a deep absorption, you feel incredibly wonderful. You feel blissful, you feel joy like you've never felt before. Is that your true nature? Because your true nature is something that doesn't come and go. And when you come out of that concentrated state, the joy, the concentration, the absorption is going to fade away. I'm not saying it's not an interesting and very valuable practice, and it has its place. But if you're not careful, again, I'm repeating myself, if you're not careful, you are trying to control your experience through focusing on your breathing, not getting too far out into other things, and or taking your attention for a period of time and truly getting it, or teaching yourself to stay concentrated and absorbed. It is a factor of awakening, it is not awakening itself. Neither is mindfulness, which is different than concentration. Mindfulness is the observation without interference, without manipulation of whatever is going on, not just the breathing. Again, a factor of awakening, it's not awakening itself. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Factors of awakening are not awakening themselves, but they assist. So there you are, you're meditating, going back to the breathing, And at some point you might have been exposed to an instruction that's, okay, let go of the breathing, just let experience happen. Let things be the way they are. This instruction, let things be the way they are, actually is an invitation to see that without your interference or manipulation, everything is always being the way it is. Wow, far out. That means the conditioned mind is always being the way it is? You betcha. As I like to say, it has a mind of its own. It does its boogie, woogie, boogie thing. You noticed? Whether you're paying attention to it or not, way it's going. Sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes hard, sometimes soft, sometimes heavy, sometimes light, sometimes hot, sometimes cool. Round and round and round and round it goes. That's relativity for human beings. So now, what allows the opening beyond the conditioned mind? Because the promise, the proclamation, the gift of spirituality, of the teachings, the ancient and contemporary teachings of awakening, is that you are more than your conditioned mind. You are more than your conditioned body-mind process. And meditation, as an art and science or lifestyle, can assist in the realization. It's funny, because the meditation itself will not make it happen. The awakening beyond the conditioned mind is a pure manifestation of grace. You can't make it happen, and the meditation itself doesn't make it happen. It's a spontaneous aha, shift in perception, opening beyond suffering, that no one makes happen, and no activity makes happen. And yet, the activity of meditation can assist, just like the factors of awakening can assist in awakening, but they don't make it happen. It's very interesting. It's kind of what some people say, particularly in the Christian traditions, not my will, but thine. And then you go around trying to live and have that figured out. If that's your mantra. So now a question that shifts from what seems to be a linear, sequential description, not prescription, description, to something that's non-linear, watch, where is the unconditioned? If the conditioned is happening here, in this body-mind process, where is the unconditioned? Notice, you can't answer that, can you? And if you try, you're just going to be shooting and an attempt to put words to something, and you can't do it. Now these words right now, hopefully, are working to help us not only describe something that's ongoingly present, these factors or these experiences of the conditioned mind, but they're working us towards pointing at words that point at something that can't be described. And this can happen spontaneously, as one is meditating, one suddenly senses, wait a minute, there's more. There's something. There's a sense that I am not just this flow of phenomena, this flow of this body-mind process, and it becomes palpable, it's real, it's amazing, it's exciting, it's peaceful, it's many things, but it happens. It's an aha, and it could be a little tiny one for a few seconds or less, or it could be big shift. And in some cases, fairly rare still, it seems, there's a shift right out of the conditioned mind and a total, you might say, shift in identity. The perceptual process and the tendency to identify with conditioning is severed. That's called awakened. Prior to that, what's going on is awakening, and everybody is biologically, molecularly hooked up already to awaken. We're dialed into it. And even the addict and the person who's compulsed with robbing and stealing is doing it because they want something. What do they want? If I get this, my life will be better. This is the drive to awaken, oddly enough. I will be better off with this. I need this. Crazy, crazy sense, though, that eventually comes if one looks and, you might say, is rehabbed enough, one goes, that's insane, that's not going to work, I need a different path. It happens for those in rehab from addictions, it happens for those in rehab from this, it happens in those from who are in the rehabilitation, and we're all in this until we're not. Rehabilitation with identification from being a body-mind process. We're all in treatment. See, we used to think just the addicts are in treatment. No, you came here, you didn't know it, you didn't sign up for it consciously, but the treatment program, the curriculum is, the classroom is, discover, learn, get to know very well, take the tests within the realm of the body-mind process, the conditioned mind, and find out who you are. We didn't know that when we signed up, did we? And they didn't tell us that either once we got here. Oh, by the way, you've just joined the curriculum. This is the curriculum of conditioning. And what you'll learn about are things that will be really painful at times and things that will be joyful, and it'll move, it'll go up and down. Even every day it'll go up and down, some back and forth, up and down, up and down, up and down. But you know what? If you pay attention and you learn how to observe closely, you can realize the promise and the proclamation of your birthright, your deepest birthright, which is to awaken beyond that. Now, we sometimes now we get abstract and we go, okay, we're going to float away and go to some other realm. No, you're not. The awakening to the unconditioned mind, I'm going to use that term tonight, or unconditioned awareness, happens right here, in this. It's not out there. It's right here in this, inside this. It happens right here. And in some ways, it is what is traditionally called original mind, true nature, the Buddha field, Buddha mind, Christ consciousness, original nature, ground of being, source consciousness, God realization, call it whatever you want. You can put whatever term you'd like there, pretty much depending on who's talking. They all point to the same thing. Some people take one of those words that I just said in there, or one of those descriptions, and they pull it out and they say, no, this is what it really is. And they say the other ones are really like something else. If you meet such a person, make sure you pin them down that they know what they're talking about. That they're not just conceptually spouting. Do you know what you're talking about? I like to try to keep these language things very simple. Let's talk about unconditioned awareness. Let's talk about the nature of awareness as unconditioned already. not as something that's going to become unconditioned later, once you've meditated enough, lived enough, suffered enough, learned enough, gone through the tests of the curriculum long enough, and now you're there. No, it's happening already. Unconditioned awareness was here from the very beginning, wherever that is. It's in this room right now. Unconditioned awareness is actually what sees the conditioned mind. At first, the scene is just, you're in there, so close, you're just wrapped up still in all of it. Slow but sure, it starts to loosen. So you could call the unconditioned awareness a space that starts to open. A room that this room sits in. How about that? A room that this room sits in. And the room that this room sits in has no walls, floor, or ceiling. It's got no edge or no boundary. It's the most obvious thing there is, and the most subtle. Because it's not actually a thing. It's not a thing in the sense that a thought is a thing, a feeling is a thing, a perception is a thing, a belief is a thing, a memory is a thing, a liking is a thing, a disliking is a thing. It's a non-thing thing, or it's a no-thing thing. See? And so it's that awareness, like a light, right? A non-discriminatory, and I mean non-prejudice or judgmental light, that starts to shine on all of these factors of conditioning. And you find out, yes, maybe it's slow, but it certainly is for sure, that the awareness is loving. The awareness is kind. The awareness is peaceful. And as it shines its light on those conditionings unravel themselves. They unfold themselves. They show their true nature. And if you've been identified with those things, lo and behold, it's very clear that the disidentification happens, a loosening of the identification. Now you still might start to be shifting over into a more subtle place of identifying yourself as awareness. Yeah? Because it's quite something to be completely unidentified. Actually, it's freedom. No identification whatsoever with anything. Even awareness. What works very beautifully is that when there's no identification, even for a second, everything functions just fine. Awareness operates just fine. What's the point of identifying with awareness? And the simple answer to that is because there's fear of death. And for some people, death means the end of awareness. They can't prove it, in most cases. I've never met anyone who could. But they believe it. And therefore, they are identified with awareness. They're attached to being aware. They're attached to consciousness. But they're not so attached to consciousness that they don't let it go very easily into deep sleep. And there we have a little twist in the fabric. We can't quite figure that out, can we? Why would I be identified with awareness in the waking state and don't give a hoot in the deep sleep state? And the answer to that, well, one potential answer to that is because something is still going on that's extremely subtle in the deep sleep state. There's some sense of something that continues. Because if you died, whatever you are, in the deep sleep state, then how could there be a waking state that follows? Something's continuing in there, and we can't figure that out. But we can begin to sense that very subtle, very sublime possibility that these words that are saying liberation means no identification with anything, nothing to hold on to, nothing to get rid of, nothing to attain, no right, no wrong, no higher, no lower. And again, this is where the mind sometimes has a little bit of, at least the thinking mind has a little bit of a problem. That part of the conditioned mind has a little bit of a problem because it's trying to understand that. And we just went into what could appear abstract, non-conceptual, non-linear, with this no stuff. And there's people who just drool almost, if not cry, every time they hear this utterance of non-dual wisdom and truth coming out of a voice like Rumi's or Hafiz. And there's others who go, oh, that doesn't make any sense. I don't understand that. It's just a poem. You notice this? And I used to have the privilege, I would say, to go and be on much more retreats, longer retreats as a student. This is back in the 80s, in the early 90s, and it became sort of a joke that the patron saint for the Vipassana community of America was Rumi, because he was being read at every retreat by this teacher and that teacher. And then people were carrying Rumi books around. You see them in the hall. They'd have the Rumi poetry book in their room. They'd be carrying it out to their car at the end of the retreat. Why was this being read so often? This was so direct, and it was funny, and it included things like women that you weren't supposed to talk about if you're evolving into a spiritual, celibate, male, enlightened being, or alcohol, and metaphorically turning it as the drunkard walking down the path, seeing the truth of the way things are. Maybe that's why some people couldn't stand it, while others were just going, yes, this is the wine of waking up. So once we get comfortable, and it doesn't always happen immediately, but it is sort of a requirement that we become comfortable with language that our conceptual mind can't understand and make sense of, other than to feel the ending of itself within those words. And then that space that opens that the words are pointing to becomes one and the same with the space of watching or awareness. And in a way, right there, you've just slid out the side door, again, Rumi image, the side door of the conditioned mind. See, we're actually going in and out of the conditioned and the unconditioned throughout our life, and we don't really know this until we awaken and see what's really happening. Now, for some people, they attempt to achieve this unconditionedness. How can you achieve something that's already happening? You don't achieve something that's already happening. What you do, in a way, is like this. It's like an inversion. You wake up to what's always been happening, but was obscured. Obscured by what? Obscured by conditioning, by habits, by identification. It's almost like this story I have to tell you. When I used to teach body work, there was always interesting people that came to classes. They were typically, in my experience, once they became comfortable, not everyone was comfortable really letting themselves express themselves freely and be themselves, everybody was eccentric, not just a few. So one day there was a fellow in class, we were in a room about this big, with a Berber carpet, like this one, and we had a little break. And the break was getting ready to end, and I was getting ready to bring folks back, you know, call them back to class. And I noticed him over in the corner with the carpet pulled up. I guess it was loose already, I hope. And he was looking underneath the carpet. And I crawled over with curiosity to find out what was going on. And I came over there, like this. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Looking." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "Nothing." Too much body work? Not enough body work? Maybe psychotherapy? How about drugs? Maybe meditation? It seemed so ridiculous in one sense, but it was utterly childlike, wonderfully wise, and beautiful. And he was just completely, to me it seemed at least, free in this. So I point that out because sometimes people are attempting to achieve this unconditioned opening, this unconditioned awareness. And the nature of the awareness is already expressing the unconditioned. And if you attempt to escape conditioning and just live in some unconditioned state, there is actually no unconditioned state because the state comes and goes. The unconditioned points at something that doesn't come and go. That's what's called the real. That's what's called the truth. That's what you truly, in essence, are. So, you could set up another duality, subtle as it may be. Here's the conditioned, and then there's something called the unconditioned, and I'm going to realize the unconditioned. No, you're not. You're not going to realize the unconditioned. You, as you perceive yourself, can't. That which is watching, that you, it perceives itself as attempting to achieve the unconditioned. That's an interesting shift. So what's happened historically, and this is very, very important to realize, is that from what we know, is that the Buddha taught in many different ways, as did Jesus, methods, practices, teachings that involve words, teachings that involve parable, simile, analogy, metaphors, pointing, for those who are listening, at the possibility of awakening. And for those who are involved in and listening to the teachings from their conditioned mind, which is what most people are doing, they're perceiving the path or the practices as progressive. I will do this, and then this, and then this, and then this. If you look at even the way the teachings are laid out in the scriptures, they seem very progressive. To what? To your mind. To what mind? To your conditioned mind. And then, of course, as is the case very clearly, there were these teachings that just fell off the edge. When the Buddha started to talk at times about the deathless, it just fell off the edge. When people try to get him to talk about metaphysics, he simply was silent. He didn't say, "I will" or "I won't," or "we should" or "we shouldn't talk about that." He didn't say anything. It was just, there's your answer for those who are ready. And you can then interpret, why did he not respond? Why didn't he say something about that? And everything that's come since that was passed on to us, that's what took place, is an interpretation. They say he didn't answer the question about metaphysics because he didn't want people confused in something that was imaginative. He wanted people to experience and to look at reality, relative and absolute, which sounds like a dichotomy, doesn't it? Conditioned, unconditioned, relative, absolute, ephemeral, eternal. Again, just words. Now what's developed and what's available now and what's streaming more than through the internet into the world that we inhabit together, we share, are teachings not only of progressive awakening but teachings of immediacy. Direct teachings of immediacy. The traditions like Dzogchen from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which for many, many hundreds, thousands of years was guarded and protected very carefully, not passed just to anybody It was very, very protected, and it was persecuted. So it was very carefully guarded and protected. And it was very precious, because what it did, that tradition, was it extracted out of the core teachings of the Buddha the particles, you might say, of immediacy, of direct, immediate realization, not progression. And for those teachings and those groups and those individuals and those priests and those teachers who believed in progression, that's a threat. If someone comes along and says, you don't have to do anything, you already are what you're seeking, here's not a way to realize that, because there is no way to realize that, but a direct transmission. The word in Sanskrit is darshan, a direct darshan of the immediacy of the nature of your being, straight up, no charge. This is a threat. It's still a threat to the conditioned mind. Because the conditioned mind sometimes doesn't want to fart and die. And if you haven't farted freely while you're alive, may you fart freely at death. Because some people do, it just comes ripping out. No inhibition anymore. Who cares how loud it goes? So what's happening then is this streaming, it's on the internet, it's coming through in all kinds of ways. The young people are extremely attracted to these teachings. They don't want to wait around. They don't want to sit on their butt for 20 years. They might be overly sensational. Yes, they might. But if there's a possibility that there's a lazy man's way to enlightenment, may I have it, and may I have it now.
What are these teachings like?
What are they like?
Yeah.
They're coming right through the poetry of Rumi, Hafiz. They're coming right through the Dzogchen teachers. They're coming right through people like Ajahn Shanti, Tony Parsons. They're coming right through all these people who hung out. Some of them got it deeper than others with Punjaji, who was a direct student of Ramana Maharshi. They came straight through Ramana Maharshi. You can go to where Ramana Maharshi spent his life. The charge is so immediate. It's unbelievably powerful. Just go to the physical place. Why is it so powerful? Because when he was dying, people were all upset, you're going to leave us. He said, well, how can I leave? What he was speaking to is, I am eternally present. And you are that too. Unless you're in the conditioned mind. And now that you asked, okay, it's coming straight through the flowers, the sun, the moon, the trees, your eyes, this room, it's everywhere. It is no particular place. Why? Because it's every place. Now that's big, but for some of us, we still need it particularized. We need it in a particular form because somehow, unbeknownst to ourselves, we don't know how to open and resonate with the wholeness of our being. Therefore, part of us is ready and part of us is not. And the part that's not looks for the truth in particular places. The part that's ready is just ready. And then the ready goes away, and it just is. Am I answering your question?
I think so. It was the word sensational. That was what I was wondering.
Yeah. Well, I was just referring to the fact that awakening isn't a sensation, and also because we're in a culture that still wants it and wants it now, particularly in California. Florida's a little too swamp-like. Too sweaty.
You don't have enough money.
Don't have enough money. There we go. Thanks, Rich. So these friends, I wish she was here tonight. She's not here. Sudhi and Natash, they've just been doing this thing out in the Bahamas where they go out in a big trimaran. And they work with a company that takes people out and you swim with the dolphins. So these groups come in and you swim with the dolphins and you have these sort of like close encounters of the dolphin kind where you're looking in their eyes and it's, you know, they're being with you, they're playing with you, you know, they're nudging you, and all this stuff happens. So they do, they've been doing this for a while, and I get their stories about this. So the group of women, sexy, they're all in bikinis, they all got tans, and they're all from California, and they're all yoga teachers, and they all come for the dolphin kiss, or whatever you want to call it, for their 5 days. Now the big event is to get what's called this technique now that's coming out, where some of you might know the word. I'm going to aim at it. Well, you get touched. It's not darshan, but you get this kind of like spiritual touch. So you feel light and tingly for a little while after this. And this was the big thing for these yoga teachers from California, was to get this touch, along with the really good food, plenty of sun, dolphins, probably pretty good sleep, little meditation. It's spiritual materialism. Or it isn't. I don't know. I wasn't there. The conditioned mind will take a hold of the very best that it hears about, smells, senses, imagines, and it'll try to own it. Give it to me and give it to me now. That's sensational. And I met young people, particularly in Europe, who do not have this sensationalism. They are just brilliantly alive and on fire for this immediacy. And they're relaxed and they're full of spiritual urgency at the same time. And I know this because I met them personally and talked with them and felt, you know. And they're not, you know, not interested in the traditions of thousands of years of waking up. They're not like, you know, ignorant of that. But they're not spending their time sitting around thinking about it and reading the scriptures, trying to figure out what they mean. So there's something pretty powerful about not just I want it and I want it now, but rather I deserve it and I deserve it now. Not from an egotistical or grasping place, but from a true place of chandra or spiritual passion. I mean, think about it. When the Shams of Tabriz and Rumi met, the Shams blew into town. Rumi was a teacher. He had his students around him. His father was a teacher, and this is the 13th century, and books are precious. The Shams' first meeting, he grabs Rumi's books and throws them in the fountain. Now they've got water all over them. They're wrecked. Basically, the message is you don't need these anymore. Could be very upsetting, but for Rumi it was like probably shocking, upsetting, and he fell into this space with the Shams, and that the love that manifested was both human and divine. And then they kill the Shams, and Rumi's completely bewildered, walking around Damascus completely heartbroken. And the realization comes, the Shams of Tabriz is my own true self. That's when the poetry started.
He didn't write while Shams is alive.
If you believe Coleman Barks, and I do, who are you going to believe? Where are the voices of authority? Eventually you have to come to your own. What do these words mean? If we get a sense of the conditioned mind, and we get a sense that there's an awakening that can take place beyond that, then what happens is that awakening beyond the conditioned mind must and will totally and completely infiltrate the conditioned world. And this is the bodhisattva expression. That's what the bodhisattva is. You know, you can sit around and think, oh, I think I'll be a bodhisattva. No, you won't. Not like that. The bodhisattva, the words have been passed down, postpones his or her own awakening till everyone else is awakened and then joins last. I would tend to slightly disagree. The bodhisattva awakens and in that awakening realizes and sees everyone else's awakening simultaneously and then does anything and everything helpful wherever he or she goes. That's the Buddha. The Buddha is a bodhisattva. Christ is a bodhisattva. There's bodhisattvas among us. Not necessarily teachers. But we can't see them, we can't experience them. If we have dust in our eyes, what is that dust in our eyes? It's our conditioned mind and our identification with it. But if it's our enemy and we're trying to get rid of it, it feeds on that. So the delicate touch, the firm but delicate touch of the meditation, it allows the conditioned mind to be seen as it is, allows it to show its nature, which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and there is no self in any of those conditions. There is no permanent, lasting self. There's no possessibility. These factors become very clear. And then the unconditioned comes forth naturally. You don't make it happen. And when it comes forth, you see that it's always been here. It's been what you have been looking for, if you've been looking for anything. It's like, ooh! And it's a delight. Right, that was a little...